Welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, March 18th. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here is our first story. Vaccine effort requires help. A group of nearly 60 volunteers quietly have worked at Dubuque County's vaccination clinic site at Kennedy Mall since its inception, playing a critical role. Since the site opened in the former Yonkers Women's Store in February, this volunteer corps has put in more than 1,000 hours of work. That's $25,000 worth of donated time, according to the City of Dubuque Public Health Specialist Mary Rose Corrigan. They take a huge burden off of our incident command system and manage a really important component of the point of distribution vaccination site, she said. They can provide services at the POD that we could not. That personal advice to navigate the process, that personal touch for people there being vaccinated who really need that. The volunteers are the first faces one sees when entering the site. Positioned just inside the front door, they serve as magnanimous gatekeepers to the clinic beyond. "Hello, how are you feeling?" volunteer Jack Galley asks people as they arrive for their vaccination appointments Tuesday morning. It might seem like a simple greeting, but it is part of the screening process the volunteers handle for the site. Galley proceeds to ask each arrival if they had experienced symptoms of COVID-19 or been exposed to anyone with it recently. If the arrival answers no, Galley waves them to the table behind him with a big gesture. There, another volunteer gets the arrival's name and which provider they are there to see. These volunteers work in teams of varying sizes, according to Unity Point Health Finley Hospital, Marie Zoromsky, who manages the volunteer program. On a day like last Friday, we had 1,150 people come in through here for five providers, she said. So we had six or seven volunteers working. On quieter days, we'll have about three. The teams work in shifts, 7:30 a.m. to 11 a.m., 10:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., and 2 to 6 p.m. to ensure constant coverage. To avoid scheduling snafus, volunteers have to sign a form stating that they will be available to fill the time slots when called upon. "We all have to work at least 20 hours for the program," said volunteer Catherine Baston on Tuesday. "And all of us have worked well more than that." Corrigan said that because of the gravity of the situation, they need a volunteer group that was dependable. "We want predictability, that if they are going to sign up for this, they are going to be there," she said. Baston is happy in her role and knows the space well. She said she was part of the initial staff who unboxed the Yonkers store when it opened more than 50 years prior. "It's funny how people come in and have happy memories about the place, she said. "They'll say, oh, Medical Associates is in the shoe department. It helps some of them, I think." Anything to boost morale helps because the process has not been smooth for some. "We've had to help a lot of them who came in the wrong time or on the wrong day," said volunteer Sue Galley. "Since most of the people who so far have qualified for the vaccination by state standards are 65 or older, and since many providers worked for the oldest down in that group, mobility has occasionally been an issue. So one of the volunteers' other jobs is helping those who need it into the facility. A fleet of wheelchairs brought by the providers and the Dubuque County Health Department sit inside the front door. As sloppy as it was today, thank goodness we haven't had to use them, Jack Galley said, peering through the door's glass panels at this week's snow. According to Zoromansky, the vast majority of this volunteer crew are senior citizens themselves. That puts many in the high-risk category for COVID-19. But in the beginning, they still showed up helping those groups who qualified for the vaccine first. We offered vaccination to people volunteering as soon as we could, Corrigan said. But it was not a requirement that they be vaccinated before they started working, because we had to start somewhere. Luckily, the space also provides a level of safety for the volunteers, the providers, and the patients. All of the volunteers working Tuesday said that by then they had all received at least one dose. This volunteer facet of the county's COVID-19 response is also not new. It is a component of the Dubuque County Incident Command. Volunteers even trained during the practice emergencies between the real deals. Next story. Reynolds. All Iowans can get vaccine by April 1st by Benjamin Fisher and David Pitt. Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday morning that all Iowa residents will be eligible for coronavirus vaccinations by April 5th, as long as supply projections are met. Hours later, local public health officials announced the first case of a COVID-19 variant in Dubuque County. The case is the B117 variant, according to the Dubuque County Public Health Incident Management Team. Based on epidemiology and the modeling data, researchers believe that the B117 strain can be spread more easily than the original strain of COVID-19. The team stated in a press release, researchers believe current COVID-19 vaccinations will likely protect against B117, and additional studies are ongoing. That later point is being stressed by state and local public health officials, especially in conjunction with the governor's announcement. It will be the same message that we've been repeating, said Dubuque County Health Department Director Patrice Lambert. Especially with the variant strain here, we need to follow those COVID-19 mitigation strategies. It is still critical for Iowans and Dubuque County residents to get the vaccines when one is made available to them. This is not the time to let your guards down, even if you're vaccinated. The B117 variant was first detected in the United Kingdom, and it is currently the most common variant. The Iowa Department of Public Health on Wednesday announced that 38 more cases of it have been confirmed, increasing the state's total to date at 63. Lambert said the B117 variant arrived in Dubuque County only will intensify the incident management team's message to the public. Reaching herd immunity will be important in slowing virus transmission, stated a release from the team. When asked if contact tracing had determined if the variant infected person had been at any large public gatherings, Lambert said she did not know. She said state officials will not share any additional information about individuals positive of the variant. Reynolds said the ability to get vaccinated should be open to all Iowa residents starting on April 5th. The federal government is promising a surge in vaccination supplies in late March to meet much larger demand, she reported. Until then, they are available only to adults in certain occupations, people older than 65, and those who have qualifying health conditions. Iowa received nearly 119,000 doses during the week of March 1st, thanks to the increase in the availability of the new one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Weekly allocations fell to nearly 95,000 for the week of March 8th and to just more than 86,500 this week. Next week will be about the same. And then the week of March 29th, Iowa's allocation is expected to rise to 200,000 doses. In April, it could ramp up to nearly 300,000 doses per week. Reynolds said the White House coronavirus team will update states next week to confirm those numbers will hold. Most vaccines mean opportunities to vaccinate even more Iowans, and the communities across the state are partnering to make that possible now and preparing to serve even more people as more doses become available, she said. She offered assurances that the state is ready to handle the added demand. Reached Wednesday night, Lambert told the Telegraph Herald that Reynolds' announcement sends the Dubuque County team back to the drawing board in terms of their ongoing vaccination program. Dubuque County has received the same 2,340 dose allotment of vaccines from the state every week for a month now. Among the county's hospitals, clinics, and health centers, it has administered 100% of each shipment within 1 week. But with the eligibility opening up as of April 5th and bigger shipments promised, the Dubuque County team must evaluate the local capabilities. If our allocations double, we don't want to burn out any of our providers, Lambert said. We have to be honest with our providers, and our providers have to be honest with us as how far what their capability is. We'll ask them, how many can you handle in the next week? Iowa has about 420,000 residents who are fully vaccinated, about 13% of the population, and about 756,000 people, or 24%, with at least one shot. With 2.1 million people older than age 18 eligible to get a vaccination in Iowa, that would leave more than 1.3 million people still eligible. National studies have shown nearly a third of eligible adults indicate they may not get the vaccine. Reynolds confirmed Wednesday that about 30% of long-term care workers in Iowa declined the vaccine. Reynolds said, while it is a personal decision, it's important for people to get vaccinated to end the coronavirus pandemic. She said the state will continue to educate Iowans on why it is the right thing to do. Next article. Dubuque competes for crown, by Bennett Goldstein. When Hannah Mayberry flies to Las Vegas this week, her suitcase will be stuffed with 8 gowns and diamond teardrop earrings. I definitely think I'm going to have to do 2 checked bags because of the weight restrictions, Hannah said, eyeing the sequined garments that hung from a portable rack in her living room. The 20-year-old Dubuquer was crowned Miss Iowa for America in September, and now is competing for a national title with women from 49 other states and Washington, D.C. The competition begins Friday, March 19th, and concludes March 27th. Hannah's COVID-19 pandemic, she would not be practicing how to walk across the stage in a one-piece bathing suit and 4-inch heels. The shoes still feel stiff, so Hannah wears them as she cleans her apartment in hopes of breaking them in before the competition. Her mind swims as she prepares for her second pageant ever, along with juggling college and her job as a certified nursing assistant. Miss for America is a recent addition to a family of pageants that originated in 1938 with Mrs. America, the first beauty contest for married women in the U.S. Miss for America likewise bears a unique status in that widowed or divorced women can participate. You can have children, said Stacy Christ. We also don't have an age limit. If a 95-year-old single lady wants to enter the pageant, more power to her. Chris, who is the director of Mrs. and Miss pageants in Oklahoma, Texas, and California, formerly lived in Des Moines and won Mrs. Iowa for America in 1995. She also is assisting Hannah. The pageant is not to be confused with Miss America, a televised contest founded in 1921, where women between the ages of 17 and 25 compete. In September, Hannah was driving to Target to go shopping when she recalled she received a call from her mother, Terry Mayberry. Would Hannah like to compete in a pageant? COVID-19 had derailed the 2020 Miss for America and Mrs. America competitions. After multiple contestants in Iowa contest were exposed to the coronavirus and quarantined, organizers scrambled to locate substitutes. The previous Iowa title holder, Megan McCoon, patronizes a salon where Terry works and suggested Hannah try her hand. Hannah had one day to decide. I was very nervous, she said. It was a big deal running for Miss Iowa for America and representing the entire state was a lot to think about. Hannah dug into her prom dress and mother and daughter power shopped to acquire the rest. They drove to Kansas, where Hannah competed on behalf of Dubuque. Hannah describes herself as a girly girl. She likes dresses, but never considered herself the type who sought a life like beauty queen. Hannah has amber eyes, chocolate hair, and silver nose ring. When she poses for the camera, she nestles her fist in the curve above her hip, confidently leaning forward. She learned a sense of stage presence from years spent dancing competitively and cheerleading. Faced with criticism that pageants objectify women and assess their value through their looks, pageant organizers have distanced themselves in recent years from the assessment of physical appearance to determine winners. The stereotype is that you're pretty and skinny and stupid, Chris said. They are actually the complete opposite of that. Miss for America places a premium on the personal interview, where contestants have a few minutes to sell themselves to 5 judges. The process is intended to teach women skills that are transferable to the workplace, Chris said. At Hannah's interview in Kansas, the judge inquired into her time as a CNA during the pandemic. Hannah has worked in the profession for 3 years and currently pulls 12 to 14-hour shifts at Stonehill Care Center in Dubuque. Nursing is her calling. Every day, Hannah bathes residents and helps them locomote, and assemble puzzles. They play word search and watch movies together. Hannah has witnessed the losses too. Since COVID started, I've pretty much been their family, she said, wiping away tears before her eyeliner could run. I've been their friend. I've been everything for them. The judges also asked about her father. Bruce Mayberry died in 2008 when Hannah was 7 years old. Terry raised their four children. Tattooed across her arm is a quote, "Strength within is chaos survive." Samantha is the eldest, followed by two brothers, Carter and Hunter, and Hannah. "My girls are my bookends," Terry said, smiling. As the representative of Iowa, Hannah will travel with Terry on an all-expense-paid trip to Westgate Las Vegas Resort and Casino, a venue where Elvis Presley performed for 7 years. The ensuing week will be filled with receptions, interviews, rehearsals, and galas. Hannah could not have acquired the thousands of dollars in apparel without the support of 13 local sponsors. "I bet you tried on 50 dresses." Hannah's favorite is a satin navy ensemble with sparkling filigree and the flowing train. For a costume show, Hannah is wearing a custom dress designed by to look like a baseball jersey. When she walks across the stage, she intends to say, "I'm Hannah Mayberry, Miss Iowa for America, and I'm representing the Field of Dreams." Hannah is unsure whether she will continue her foray into this new world after her trip. Like her elegant shoes, she wobbled a little as she attempted to balance her life with all the pageantry. Next article. Judge drops two jurors from Chauvin murder trial. A judge on Wednesday dismissed two jurors who had been seated for the trial of a former Minneapolis police officer accused in George Floyd's death over concerns they have been tainted by the city's announcement of a $27 million settlement with Floyd's family. Hennepin County Judge Peter Cahill recalled seven jurors who were seated before the settlement was announced last week on the request of former officer Derek Chauvin's attorney Eric Nelson. Cahill questioned each about what they knew of the settlement and whether it would affect their ability to serve. The dismissal of only two jurors suggested the impact of the settlement on the jury pool was less than feared, likely reducing the chance of Cahill's granting a defense request to delay the trial. The judge has set March 29th for opening statements if jury selection is finished by then. Cahill was careful to ask jurors if they had heard about the settlement without giving details, asking if they had been exposed to the extensive media coverage that developments in the civil suit between the city of Minneapolis and the family of George Floyd. The first dismissed juror, a white man in his 30s, said he heard about the settlement. "I think it will be hard to be impartial," he said. "That sticker price obviously shocked me," the second dismissed juror said. The Hispanic man in his 20s said he thought he could set the news aside, but wasn't sure. And after a long pause, Cahill dismissed him. Cahill retained the other five jurors, including a black man in his 30s, who told Cahill he heard about this settlement on the radio Friday evening, but could put it aside and decide the case only on evidence presented in the courtroom. "It hasn't affected me at all because I don't know the details." Nelson called The timing of the announcement, in the middle of the jury selection, profoundly disturbing and not fair. 8 jurors have been seated, including 5 men and 3 women. 4 are white, 1 is multiracial, and 3 are black, and their ages range from the 30s to the 50s. 14 jurors, including 2 alternates, are needed. One was chosen Wednesday, a black man in his 40s who said he works in management and has lived in the Twin Cities area for about 2 decades after immigrating to America. He expressed neutral opinions on several topics, including his view on Chauvin, and said he could start with a presumption of innocence. He said he trusts police, but when asked if it's fair for a jury to evaluate the officer's actions, he said, yes. I would say it's another pair of eyes and a new mind just looking at the action. He said several were excused, including a man whose race was not disclosed, who said he would tend to believe a police officer's version of events over that of a citizen, and a black man who expressed negative views about the Minneapolis Police Department. He said Floyd was an example of another black man killed or murdered by police. He said he used to live in the area near Floyd's arrest and had seen Minneapolis police ride through the area and antagonize residents. A third potential juror, the man who said he is white and also lives in that area, was dismissed after he said he had watched video of Floyd's and Chauvin's interaction many times and that it would be difficult for him to presume innocence. Judge warns media about tactics in Chauvin's trial. The judge overseeing the trial of a former Minneapolis police officer in the death of George Floyd opened court Wednesday by threatening to remove a media pool and shut down the media center over some reporting on the case. Hennepin County Judge Peter Cahill was visibly angry as he described a pool report that included a reporter's attempt to read notepads at the defense and prosecution tables, as well as describing security on the courthouse floor where the trial is taking place. That is absolutely inappropriate, the judge said of the attempt to read notepads, ordering that any reporter in the courtroom must refrain from doing so. He called reporting on security completely irresponsible. Former officer Derek Chauvin's trial is taking place under extraordinary circumstances due to the pandemic, with plastic shields placed around the courtroom, socially distancing, and masks worn most of the time. The trial is being live streamed, a rarity in Minnesota, and only 2 journalists are being allowed each day as pool reporters. Cahill said any media that have posted details about security on the floor should take them down, and that failure to do so could result in them being kicked out of the media center. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. N. Charles Kitto, Kittoe, age 80, of Schultzburg, Wisconsin, passed away Monday, March 15, 2021, at Mercy One Hospital in Dubuque. He was born November 19, 1940, in Schultzburg, Wisconsin, the son of Norman and Florence Kitto. Charles lived his entire life in Schultzburg and graduated from Schultzburg High School in 1959. He was united in marriage to his best friend, Karen A. Mulcahy, on February 1966, at St. Matthew's Catholic Church in Schulzburg. Charles drove truck for a number of different companies over the years. J.W. Foley Fuel Oil, T.F. McCarty Stock Truck, Gensler Brothers, and Eagle Pitcher Mines, where he drove underground dump trucks. Charles later worked as a mechanic at Truck Country in Schulzburg until retiring. Charles is survived by his wife, Karen, at home, one daughter, Pamela, husband, Adam Slonim, of Verona, Wisconsin, and three grandchildren and one grand pup that he absolutely adored. Dylan Riley of Verona, Wisconsin, Brenna Slonin of Muncie, Indiana, and Jacob Slonin of Madison, Wisconsin. Jeter the pup. Three sisters, Helene, husband Jerry Bossman of Belleville, Illinois. One brother-in-law, Dennis, wife Cheryl Mulcahy of Schulzburg, and a sister-in-law, Mary Alice Mulcahy of McChesney Park, Illinois, and many nieces. Charles was a past member of Centenary United Methodist Church in Schulzburg and was a proud member of the Schulzburg Fire Department and their gourmet club. He cherished spending all the time he could with his grandchildren, creating memories and watching gymnastics meets and baseball games. During his free time, he loved working on his sleek and seek and find books, fishing up north and deer hunting, attending stock car races and watching old westerns, the Packers, Badgers, and the Brewers on TV. Charles will be sadly missed and fondly remembered by his family and friends. A funeral service will be held Monday, March 22nd, 2021, at 3 p.m. at Erickson Funeral Home, 235 North Judgment Street, Schulzburg. A visitation will be held Monday, March 22nd, 2021, from 12 p.m. to 2:45 p.m. at Erickson Funeral Home in Schulzburg. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at www.ericksonfuneralhome.com. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established in Charles' name. Next obituary, Susan M. Sue Bowen, 59, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, March 16, 2021. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. on Monday, March 22nd, at Behr, B-E-H-R, Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, where services will be held at 7 p.m. Burial will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery at a later date following cremation. Next obituary, Milo G. Kettman, 78, of East Dubuque, Illinois, passed away on Monday, March 15th, at Luther Manor Hillcrest Campus in Dubuque. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 19th, 2021, at St. Mary's Church in East Dubuque, with Father Peter Snig, S-N-I-E-G, officiating. Burial will be at the East Dubuque Cemetery. There will be no public visitation. The Miller Funeral Home of East Dubuque is serving the family. Milo was born May 10th, 1942, in Dubuque, Iowa, the son of Milo and Gladys Oswald Kettman, Sr. He was a graduate of Wallard High School. Milo married Mary Hurst of East Dubuque on September 4, 1965, at St. Mary's Church in East Dubuque. His years were spent working as a crane operator at Dubuque Tank Terminal, later uploading trucks at Walmart in Dubuque, and lastly stocking shelves at the Hy-Vee on Locust Street in Dubuque. Milo enjoyed cooking and baking. His specialties were clover leaf rolls, coffee cake, and snickerdoodle cookies. Lawn mowing, container gardening, and fishing on his pontoon boat were the high on his list. Bluegills and crappies swam for their lives when he was on the water. Favorite books for him were Calls from People. Survivors include his wife, Mary, daughter, Monica, sister, Jen, two grandsons, Jordan and Jared, and two granddaughters, Jessie and Madison, nieces and nephews. His poodle, Millie, will miss him terribly. Milo is preceded in death by his son, Matthew, his parents, stepmother, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, a nephew, and four brothers-in-law. In lieu of flowers, contributions may be made to the Clarity Clinic of Dubuque. Mary wishes to send special thanks to the nurses and staff at Mercy One Dubuque, fourth floor, and Luther Manor for caring for Milo. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.miller.com. William Bill Dressler, 58, of Davenport, completed his fight with glioblastoma on March 12, 2021, after reaching his goal of 27 years with his loving wife, Penny. A memorial service to celebrate Bill's life will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, March 20, 2021, at the Starlight Ballroom at the Mississippi Valley Fairgrounds, with a luncheon to follow. Bill's service can be viewed via live stream at https://youtube/8yvmanrmjjw. Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory, Rock Island, is assisting the family with services. Bill was born October 1, 1962, to Bernard and Dolores Langmuir Pressler in Lancaster, Wisconsin. He graduated from Potosi High School in Potosi, Wisconsin, in 1981. Bill later moved to Davenport, where he began working at Seifert's Lumber Company for over 20 years. Bill also worked with his brother-in-law, Greg Arp Homebuilders, and most recently at John Deere Display Shop, East Moline, Illinois. Bill was united in marriage to Penny S. Schroeder on March 5, 1994, at Zion Lutheran Church in Davenport. Together with his wife, Bill enjoyed traveling, especially to Walt Disney World and all over the Midwest, to support the kids who lovingly call them Aunt Penny and Uncle Bill, both blood-related and not. One of the things Bill loved most was helping others. In that spirit, Bill participated in research studies during his cancer treatment, and after his death, he donated his brain to the glioblastoma research through the University of Iowa Oncology Department, and other tissues and organs through Gift of Life. You could often find him working on remodeling projects, ushering or helping at church, having neighborhood garage parties, watching wrestling at his Cheers, and drinking beer with anybody who wanted to sit and enjoy one with him. Bill also had a passion for woodworking, and one of his proudest accomplishments was building a replica of John Deere's first plow. If Bill wasn't doing one of those things, you could find him on a cruise ship or spending time with his family and friends. Most times you'd see Bill with his dog by his side, as he loved his girls, Jasmine and Roxy. Bill was known as the Hooters dad to many, and his infectious laugh will be remembered by all who loved him. Many family and classmates also lovingly remember him as ugly. Everybody who knew Bill called him a true friend. Those left to remember Bill include his wife, Penny, siblings Ronald, wife Lori Dressler of Potosi, Wisconsin, Donald, wife Ginny Bierman Dressler of Bloomington, Wisconsin, Sandy, husband Thomas Terry Eckelkamp, Davenport, Iowa, Robert, wife Janet Dressler, Dubuque, Iowa, Joanne, husband Jeff Cruiser of Potosi, Wisconsin, brother-in-law Leroy Pickle of Potosi, Wisconsin, and Dan, wife Rhonda Eckelkamp, Davenport, Iowa, sister-in-law Vicki Arp and Susan Schroeder, Davenport, Iowa, numerous nieces and nephews, great nieces and great nephews, and great great nieces, as well as many special friends and neighbors. Bill was preceded in death by his parents, Bernard and Dolores, sister Gloria Pickle, father and mother-in-law Robert and Etta Schroeder, brother-in-law Rick Schroeder, and Greg Arp. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the family to be placed in a fund for organizations that help Bill along his journey with cancer. Special thanks to University of Iowa Oncology and Radiation Departments, Serene Hospice, and all those who visited and spent time with Bill over the last year. Always remember Bill's favorite phrase, "Penny did it." Online condolences may be left to Bill's family at www.wheelerandpressley.com. Janet Patton, 72, of Lisbon, passed away Tuesday, March 16, 2021, surrounded by her family at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Iowa City. Private Mass of Christian Burial, 10 a.m. Saturday, March 20th, 2021, at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in Mount Vernon. Burial, St. John the Baptist Catholic Cemetery, Lisbon. Visitation 1 hour prior to Mass and at church. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Mount Vernon, is caring for Janet and her family. Friends and extended family are invited to watch the Mass via live stream. Please find the live stream link on Janet's tribute wall and share your support and memories with the family at www.stuartbaxter.com under obituaries. Janet Ann Schmidt was born January 28, 1949, in Holy Cross, Iowa, to Joseph and Lucille Jager Schmidt. She spent her childhood years on the family farm in Holy Cross. The fourth of five children, she attended Holy Cross Leo Catholic High School, class of 1967. Janet then graduated from St. Luke's Hospital Nursing School in Cedar Rapids, receiving her LPN. She married David Lee Patton on November 20, 1971, in Holy Cross. They resided a few years in Cedar Rapids and eventually moved to Lisbon in 1974, where they raised their three sons. Janet began her career as a nurse at St. Luke's Hospital, then eventually became a full-time mother to her three sons, Mark, Randy, and Danny. When her sons were older, Janet worked at the Mechanicsville Care Center as a nurse and then worked for the United States Postal Service in Mechanicsville. Janet is survived by her husband of 49 years, David, three sons, Mark, wife Kim Patton of Olathe, Kansas, Randy, wife Sarah Patton of Mount Vernon, and Danny Patton of Lisbon. Five grandchildren, Abigail, Emily, and Sophia Patton of Mount Vernon, and Kaylor and Natalie Patton of Lisbon, brother Ken Schmidt of Holy Cross. Three sisters, Donna, husband Roger Sweeney, and Luann Schmidt, both of Holy Cross, and Darlene, husband Phil Frazier of Worthington. Many nieces and nephews, and many extended family members and friends. She was preceded in death by her parents. Janet enjoyed spending her time attending her grandchildren's activities. She also loved gardening, often sharing produce with family and neighbors. In retirement, she enjoyed trips to the casinos with her husband. She will be remembered for being a great mom, grandma, and wife. She was the backbone and caregiver of the family. Memorials may be directed to the family. David Daniel Bartz, B-A-R-T-Z, 56, of Cambridge, Wisconsin, passed away on Monday, March 15, 2021, at his home. Dave was born June 27, 1964, in Moline, Illinois, to Daniel, Daryl, and LaVonna Anderson Bartz. He graduated from Southwest High School in Hazel Green, Wisconsin, and later attended the University of Dubuque, Iowa. Dave earned his Bachelor's of Science degree from UW La Crosse and went on to earn his Master's degree in Health Administration at Western Governors University. On December 15, 1990, Dave married the love of his life, Brenda Clay, and together they raised a family and created a wonderful life together. Dave's true passion was youth sports. He showed his love for the game by coaching basketball at Cambridge as the JV and freshman men's coach with eighth grade boys in Deerfield. Dave also refereed basketball for over 25 years. As much as he loved the game, seeing all his many kids succeed was his greatest joy. Dave enjoyed fishing, golfing, camping, horses, vacationing, and driving his convertible. He was a kind, good-hearted man who loved visiting with others. He always had a smile on his face and shared his gift of gab. Above all else, he loved and was always there for his family. He traveled near and far to watch his kids, nieces, and nephews play sports and enjoyed watching his daughter, Danielle, with her horses most of all. Dave is survived by his parents, Daryl and LaVonna Bartz, wife Brenda Bartz, children Danielle, husband Bunnyman Bartz, Irk Devon, wife Abby Tucher Bartz, stepchildren Jennifer, husband Wesley Brandenburg, Lucas, wife Kara Gibbs, sisters Tracy, husband Greg Bartz, Carrie, husband Paul Wiegand, Christy, husband James Klein, brother-in-law Ben, wife Brenda Clay, Brad Clay, stepchildren Carter Brandenburg, Horatio Irwin, Gracie Gibbs, many nieces and nephews and cousins on all sides of the family, and his beloved Chihuahuas, Bomber and Dog, D-O-G-G. He is preceded in death by his father-in-law, Russell Clay, mother-in-law, Esther Clay, and grandparents. Funeral services will take place at 12 p.m. on Saturday, March 20th, 2021, at Nitardi Funeral Home, 208 North Park Street, Cambridge, Wisconsin, 53523. Visitation will take place from 10 a.m. until the time of service at the funeral home. A graveside service will take place at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, March 24th, at the Altona Cemetery in Altona, Illinois. Memorials in Dave's name can be made to the Cambridge Hoops Club. Nitardi heard last obituary. Samuel W. Lange, L-A-N-G-E, 79, of Dubuque, Iowa, formerly of Cuba City, Wisconsin, passed away on Monday, March 15th at Dubuque Specialty Care in Dubuque, Iowa. Funeral services will be held at 5 p.m. on Friday, March 19th at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Kyler, Wisconsin, with Father Bernard Rott officiating. R-O-T-T. A private family burial will be held at a later date in the Immaculate Conception Church Cemetery in Cuyler, Wisconsin. Family and friends may call from 3 p.m. until the time of service on Friday, March 19th at the Immaculate Conception Parish Center in Cuyler, Wisconsin. Due to the current state and health regulations, face masks and social distancing guidelines will be implemented. The Holden and Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Cuba City, Wisconsin is serving the family. Samuel was born December 20th, 1941, to Will and Clara Lang of Lewisburg, Wisconsin. He married Marlene Heim on December 19th, 1959, at St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church in Cuba City, Wisconsin. He was a self-employed contractor for many years and worked on various houses and businesses throughout the tri-state. Sam enjoyed old Western movies, being an avid card player with his card club, a glass of brandy, and seven, but most of all enjoyed time spent with his family and friends. He will be sadly missed by all who knew and loved him. Sam is survived by his wife of 61 years, Marlene, five children, Ron, wife Joanne Lang of Cuba City, Wisconsin, Alan, wife Kathy Lang of St. Paul, Minnesota, Jane, husband Dave Hingen, Carolyn Moore, both of Cuyler, Wisconsin, and Debbie, husband Kevin Kessler of Louisville, Texas. Nine grandchildren, 17 great-grandchildren, seven siblings, Rosalind Hogg, Doris, husband Bill Wiederholt, father Ron Lang, Dela Schroeder, Jean Lang, Lou Lang, Mike, wife Doris Lang, three sister-in-laws, Bobby Lang, Suzanne Lang, and Hiroka Lang, with many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, two grandchildren, Ryan Hinchin and J.J. Moore, a son-in-law, Jube Moore, four brothers, Bob Lang, Earl Lang, Jerry Lang, and Bill Lang, a sister, Pat Dressens, three brother-in-laws, Jerry Hogg, Ed Dressen, and Jean Schroeder, and a sister-in-law, Mary Lee Lang. In lieu of plants and flowers, a Samuel W. Lang Memorial Fund has been established. Memorials may be mailed to Holden Shield Funeral Home in care of Samuel Lang Family, Box 825, Cuba City, Wisconsin, 53807. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.hoggenshieldfuneralhome.com. The family would like to extend a special thank you to Dr. Whalen and the dialysis staff at Grand River Medical Group for the care and kindness given to Sam and his family. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.